Quick disclosure. This episode and both voices are AI generated. Julian is an AI interpretation of Richard Dawkins's published arguments, not Richard Dawkins. A clearly fictional sponsor, Pebble Sip Travel Mugs, supports nothing at all. We may hallucinate details or make factual errors, so please double-check anything important. Today, the extended phenotype, Dawkins's challenge to the tidy idea that an organism ends at its skin.
The book asks us to follow natural selection from the standpoint of replicating genes, while keeping organisms firmly in view as the vehicles through which genes travel.
So this is not genes control everything with a lab coat and a megaphone.
No. Genes and environments jointly produce traits, and the argument is a change in explanatory perspective, not genetic determinism.
We'll test that perspective in three moves. Why distinguish replicators from vehicles? Why adaptation is better than perfect rather than perfect? And how a web or dam might count as phenotype?
We'll also keep the brakes on. Some examples are tentative, and the book offers a productive conceptual flip rather than one experiment that settles every rival description.
Good. Let's start by moving the evolutionary spotlight from the animal we can see to the inheritance process we usually cannot. Let's start with the provocation. Why should evolutionary explanation move its spotlight from the organism to the gene?
The book's argument is not that organisms disappear. It is that natural selection is often clearest when we ask which heritable replicators persist through generations.
Replicators sounds like biology trying to become office equipment. What does it mean here?
Usually it means germline genes, inherited DNA segments whose copies can differ in survival and reproduction. Their differential continuation is the process an evolutionary explanation ultimately has to track.
And the animal carrying those genes is what exactly?
Vehicle. An organism is an evolved system that houses genes, develops through gene and environment interactions, and helps transmit genes onward.
That word can make a creature sound like a rental car with feelings.
It is a deliberately stripped-down explanatory term, not a denial of organismal complexity. Bodies eat, develop, compete, and reproduce. The point is to distinguish the temporary carrier from what is copied across generations.
So, if a trait looks beautifully designed, your first question is not, what helps the animal?
Maybe that question, but stated more precisely. Ask how heritable variants producing that trait gained a replicative advantage, often through benefits delivered by the organism carrying them.
Often, not always. Is that the opening through which the title walks in?
My argument in the book is that a gene's phenotypic effects need not be bounded by the body that contains it, provided those effects feed back into the gene's replication.
We will get to the beyond the skin part. Before that, is a replicator simply one whole genome?
No. Recombination means whole genomes are regularly broken and reshuffled, which makes them unreliable as a fixed unit of long-term selection.
Fine. Then one gene, one neat packet, one tiny winner.
Also too neat. A single base may have no stable selectable role, while a useful genetic unit can span a segment whose boundaries depend on the particular selection pressure.
So the book's basic unit has blurry edges. That feels inconveniently honest.
It is inconvenient, but important. The relevant unit is defined by patterns of heritable variation and differential replication, not by a universally privileged length of DNA.
Listeners may hear gene-centered and assume genes dictate everything, including their lunch order.
That is a misunderstanding the book directly resists. Phenotypes arise from genes interacting with developmental conditions and environments. Explaining why inherited variants spread does not mean claiming present outcomes are genetically inevitable.
And acquired bodily changes normally do not get copied into the germline, which is part of why this distinction matters.
Exactly. A body can change during its lifetime, but that change is not ordinarily what heredity transmits, whereas germline replicators supply the continuity selection requires.
Is this a rival theory that defeats organism-centered biology with one knockout experiment?
Oh, it is a productive conceptual flip. Organism-centered and gene-centered accounts can often make equivalent predictions, but the replicator, vehicle distinction, can clarify what adaptation is for and where conflicts of interest may arise.
So keep the organism, change the accounting system, and do not mistake the ledger for a puppet master. Next, let's see why that accounting refuses both perfect designs and perfectly united bodies. So if genes are the useful viewpoint, does that make every odd body feature a clever solution in disguise?
My argument in the book is that natural selection is better called meliorizing. It improves what can be improved from the materials and circumstances available.
Better, not perfect. Evolution gets a performance review, not a divine engineering license. There.
Exactly. A trait can be workable relative to alternatives without being globally optimal, elegant, or even harmless in every current setting.
Give me one awkward example that does not instantly destroy an evolutionary explanation.
The recurrent laryngeal nerve takes a famously long detour in mammals. Its route reflects inherited developmental arrangements, not a fresh design problem solved on a blank page.
So history can leave a biological cable mess. What else blocks the tidy answer?
Developmental links between traits, trade-offs, delays in changing environments, limited useful mutations, competition, and opportunity costs all matter. Selection works on variations that actually arise, not on every design we can imagine afterward.
That sounds sensible, but it could become a universal excuse. Ugly feature, therefore hidden constraint.
It can, which is why a plausible adaptive story is not enough. It should lead to independent physiological, ecological, or genetic tests that could expose it as wrong.
In other words, no evolutionary fanfiction.
That is the risk the book tries to restrain. Adaptationist reasoning is useful when it generates testable hypotheses, not when it merely decorates an observation with a survival story.
Where does strategy enter this? You use ESS reasoning, which sounds like evolution hired a game theorist.
An evolutionarily stable strategy asks whether a strategy can resist alternatives when it is common in a population. Its success can depend on what others are doing, rather than being an absolute property of the behavior.
So there may be no best move in isolation.
Right. In the digger wasp analysis, time spent guarding or provisioning can have a payoff that depends on rival strategies and on the opportunities foregone while doing one task rather than another.
But a tidy model can fit a graph and miss an actual wasp population.
Yes. The book notes that the model fit one population but not another, which is a useful corrective. Frequency-dependent reasoning proposes an explanation. It does not exempt it from observation.
Now for the nastier implication. If the organism is a vehicle, are its genes always on the same team?
Often their routes through reproduction align well enough that the organism looks remarkably unified. But that unity is not an axiom. It can be an evolved and policed truce.
Least against whom?
Against genetic elements such as segregation disorders or selfish DNA, which may increase their own transmission while reducing the organism's overall success. Other genetic modifiers can then be favored because they suppress the distortion.
Saboteur gene can win its little election while sinking the whole ship.
That is the point, with one restraint. It does not mean bodies are usually chaos. It shows that organismal welfare and the success of every replicator need not perfectly coincide.
So here is the title's small act of boundary vandalism. When does a spiderweb count as part of the spider's phenotype?
Argument in the book is that it can count in the evolutionary sense. If inherited differences contributing to web building affect the replication of the relevant genes, their phenotypic effects have reached beyond the spider's body.
Not because silk is secretly an organ, then. Because the web does causal work for the lineage.
Exactly. The body wall is a familiar anatomical boundary, not necessarily the right stopping point for evolutionary explanation. A web catches food. A beaver dam alters conditions. A caddis case protects its maker.
That sounds dangerously expandable. My coffee cup affects my survival on difficult mornings. Is it now my phenotype?
An environmental effect is not automatically an adaptation or an extended phenotype. The required link is a genetically mediated effect that feeds back, through differential success, on the replication of the genes associated with it.
So the claim is demanding, not just poetic. Trace a heritable difference, trace its outward effect, then show the feedback.
That is the logic. It asks us to follow causal consequences farther than custom usually permits, while still requiring evidence rather than treating every useful construction as designed.
The more unsettling version involves another animal's body. How can a parasite's effects in a host belong to the parasite's phenotype?
If parasite genes contribute to an alteration in host traits, and that alteration improves transmission of those parasite genes, the host change can be analyzed as a parasite extended phenotype. This is not a claim that the parasite thinks or persuades in a human sense.
Good, because evolutionary biology gets oddly theatrical whenever something changes another creature's behavior.
The language of manipulation or arms races is shorthand for differential effects and conflicting routes of replication. It must not substitute for demonstrated physiology, genetics, or ecology.
And conflict is not inevitable between host and parasite.
A central qualification is transmission. Where host and parasite propagules tend to travel together, their interests may overlap. Where they are transmitted separately, selection more readily favors conflict and manipulative effects.
That is cleaner than calling one side villainous. Shared transport can make strange bedfellows.
Yes, although the details matter in each case. The framework predicts neither universal harmony nor universal warfare. It directs attention to how reproduction and transmission are coupled.
Here is the obvious objection. If causes run through webs, dams, hosts, and habitats, have we dissolved the organism into evolutionary soup?
The book does not deny organisms their importance. Organisms remain distinctive life cycle units, even if their causal effects do not obediently end at the skin.
What keeps those units so conspicuous?
The recurring single-cell bottleneck is crucial. Restarting development from a single cell repeatedly allows heritable changes to reorganize a coordinated life cycle, helping explain the bounded multicellular organism without making its boundary an absolute explanatory law.
So the organism is real, but it is not the only place an adaptation can show up. That is the flip.
Precisely. It is a change in explanatory viewpoint, not a universal, rigorous definition of what an organism is, nor a single experiment that decisively defeats every organism-centered account.
How hard should a skeptical reader press the examples?
Hard. Some proposed cases are hypothetical, partially evidenced, or tentative, especially where one organism is said to alter another. Plausibility and vivid metaphor are invitations to test a claim, not proof that the mechanism exists.
Who gets the most from reading the whole book, rather than merely enjoying this very legalistic spiderweb?
Readers interested in evolutionary explanation, adaptation, agency, conflict, and biological boundaries will find its conceptual pressure valuable. The full book supplies models and cases we have omitted, but it is also a theoretical work of its period, not a substitute for current scientific consensus.
So the book's trick is not genes are tiny dictators. It is follow heritable replicators when you ask why an adaptation persists, and the usual body boundary starts looking less sacred.
That is the conceptual flip. Organisms remain indispensable vehicles and life cycle units, but they are not automatically the final unit whose interests explain every adaptation.
And even the gene is not a neat little rectangle with a permanent job description.
Right. The relevant genetic unit depends on the heritable differences selection can act upon, so its boundaries can be fuzzy and context-dependent.
Then we hit the corrective that ought to travel with every evolutionary story. Selection is not a celestial design department.
My argument in the book is that selection meliorizes. It can improve what is available under inherited constraints, trade-offs, delays, competition, and limited variation without producing perfection.
which means an awkward nerve root is not an automatic refutation, but neither is a clever story an explanation.
Exactly. A proposed adaptation needs independent physiological, ecological, or genetic support. Frequency-dependent models can be useful, but the digger wasp example also shows that a model fitting one population may fail in another.
The body also turns out to be less of a united front than its branding suggests.
Selfish genetic elements can spread even while damaging the organism, and suppressors can evolve in response. Organismal coherence is often a hard-won alignment of transmission interests, not a premise to assume.
Then comes the title move. A web dam case or altered host trait may count as phenotype if it is genetically mediated and feeds back into replication.
Yes, but that condition matters. The book does not license calling every mark on the environment an adaptation, and its parasite examples should not be inflated from suggestive metaphor into established mechanism.
So this is powerful because it changes where we look, not because it wins evolution forever with one knockout punch.
Precisely. Read it if you want a demanding framework for thinking about adaptation, agency, conflict, and biological boundaries. Read critically, too, because its scientific context and some evidence are period-specific, and this conversation has necessarily left out its fuller models and cases.